¿Qué es Daytown?
Daytown es un evento que transcurre en el corazón de Madrid y Barcelona un sábado de cada mes. Reunimos a nuestros alumnos con angloparlantes nativos para hablar y hablar desde el desayuno hasta la hora del té.
Llámanos para información en Madrid al 91-133-5833 o en Barcelona al 93-339-8687.
You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
Es el momento de descubrir las claves del éxito. De la mano de Richard Vaughan y Javier Fernández Aguado. No te quedes sin tu plaza para el seminario Emprender y Liderar. Las claves del éxito. El próximo martes 29 de enero, de 16:30 a 20:30 horas, en la oficina central de Vaughan, en la calle Orense 69, primera planta. Entra en grupovaughan.com/seminario. Ahora es tu momento.
Gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. You are listening to Vaughan Radio, Vaughan Radio, and I am your host. My name is Guy Williams. Now, on this program, I'm going to be speaking to you about Giulio de' Medici. Giulio de' Medici. He was born in 1478. And, of course, with the name Medici, where would that be? That would be Florence. Okay, we often say Medici as well. Medici or Medici. Okay, he was the son of Giuliano de Medici, although illegitimate, born out of wedlock. That's how we say it, out of wedlock, which means that he was a bastard. Now, his uncle, Lorenzo, raised him. This is Lorenzo the Magnificent. The patron of the arts, the banker, the tramador, right? The schemer, taimado, sly, and, well, a Medici. And this boy, Giuliano, probably because he was a bastard, much better to get him out of the way. And the place to get people out of the way, right? Sons of illegitimate children of very important people, all of them had a place in the church. So yes, this was the big repository of unwanted children. So yes, Archbishop of Florence, and then cardinal in 1513. Now, the fact that he got on the fast track to be archbishop and cardinal, that was because his cousin was the Pope. Pope Leo the Tenth, no, Leon Decimo, Pope Leo the Tenth was his cousin. And the Medicis were very, very much, this was a strong connection between Florence and Rome. Remember, when you study the Renaissance, you get the Florentine Renaissance, but then you get the Roman Renaissance as well. As cardinal, he was the one who sort of discovered Raphael And he was the one who got Raphael to paint that Transfiguration altarpiece, right? The sacristy in Florence, Michelangelo, all of these things that, all of these initiatives of the great Renaissance artists at that time with the Medicis and the, again, in Rome. Okay. At that time, the big problem was France and the Habsburgs. In France, you had King Francis I and the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V. There had been a fight to see who was going to be Holy Roman Emperor, but Charles had won. He had won because of bribes, enormous bribes, paid to the electors. This was more than Francis could afford. At this time, France was surrounded by Habsburgs, by enemy territory. And there was really only one way for France to break free, to find living space, to open up, and that was to go into Italy. So Italy became one big battlefield. Now, the Pope vacillated between France and the Habsburgs. The Habsburgs and France. And at first, he supported the Holy Roman Emperor. He supported Carlos V in the fighting that ended in the Battle of Pavia. That was in 1525. Our listeners will remember that 1525, you know, this is simultaneous to the fall of Tenochtitlan. This is when Cortes began to take over. Francis, at that point, was taken prisoner. If I remember correctly, he spent the time in the Torre de Lujanes in Madrid. Now, Francis escaped and founded the League of Cognac, trying to oppose Charles. And Giulio de Medici, now Clement the Seventh, now Pope, Clement the Seventh sided with France against Charles. So, this anti-imperial policy meant that Charles was going to have all kinds of problems in Germany. Clement, the Medicis, you know, once they had started to build St. Peter's in Rome and started to raise funds for that in Germany, this is one of the big reasons that the Germans rebelled. All of their money going south of the Alps, and they're not seeing any benefits for it. And of course, Martin Luther, incensed that some of the fundraisers would sell indulgences, so that you could, for a price, you could get rid of your own sins or the sins of your loved ones. They had a sales technique talking about how all of your relatives are suffering in hell or purgatory, and how, with a little money, going to a good cause, St. Peter's in Rome, how you could get them out of hell or get them out of purgatory. And this, of course, this was the la gota que colmó el vaso, right? The last straw for Martin Luther. Of course, Clement couldn't see any of this, didn't understand it, underestimated it, and underestimated what would happen if he joined the League of Cognac. His anti-imperial policy meant that the Germans didn't like him. It meant that the Spaniards didn't like him. the troops serving under Charles didn't like him. And in 1527, this is the same year that Hernán Cortés had decided to come back to Spain and interview with the emperor. That same year, the emperor needed some good news. This is the year that the emperor really got along with Cortés and sort of confirmed him in, as captain general, and gave him the title of Marqués del Valle, giving him enormous powers in Mexico, enormous powers. So Charles needed some good news, because that year, earlier that year, 6 months before his interview with Cortés, imperial forces had gone into the city of Rome with total destruction and massacre in mind. The population was terrorized. And of course, the Pope, who really didn't know what he was doing, was humiliated. Clement the VII, again, known as his father, his, all of these sort of Renaissance princes, they were supposed to be clever. They were supposed to be strategic. They were supposed to, conspire, and they were supposed to know how to do things. But the fact is that they didn't. The preceding popes, Alexander the VI, Julius the III, and Leo the X, all of them, much more like Renaissance sort of princes, especially Alexander the VI, the Borgia, right? Not really holy at all, not really divine at all, but more like plotters, conspirers. But in this case, Clement the VII, the worst of all, humiliated when these troops come in. The German Landsknecht were mercenaries, and many of them were Protestant. And, of course, they hadn't been paid. The Swiss Guard, there were only about 2,000 of them, and the city garrison, 8,000. They couldn't stand up in the face of the cannon, and the muskets. They tried to defend St. Peter's, the Basilica, and Pope Clement was successfully able to escape down that special tunnel going from St. Peter's into the Castel Sant'Angelo, right, into the mausoleum there. And he was put under siege while the city was destroyed. St. Peter's was desecrated, and all of this was somewhat humiliating to Charles V, but at the same time, Clement surrendered. he paid an enormous indemnity and gave Charles V substantial territory. So the balance was positive, but still it meant that that Charles was going to have problems. First of all, Clement really wanted to help out Henry VIII. Henry VIII had requested the annulment of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. And, yeah, it was going to be very difficult to say yes with Charles breathing down his neck, right? Charles being her nephew, the Holy Roman Emperor, who is now in charge of Rome as the nephew. Now, with that reform in Germany, Charles let Clement VII go with this indemnization, but without any guarantee that there was going to be clerical reform, ecclesiastical reform, doctrinal reform in the church. And so, because of this, this is when he really lost Germany. There were many princes in Germany who were undecided about the Reformation. But when with somebody like Clement in charge, it was understood that the Reformation was not going to happen. And Charles simply let him go without insisting. And this is what led to open rebellion. Now, by the year 1530, Charles had been crowned by Clement in Bologna, in Italy. By the way, this is the last imperial coronation by a pope. After this time, after procrastination and enough to secure an anti-church party in England, right? Henry VIII at this point simply broke with Rome, and Act of Supremacy followed in 1534, making the King of England the head of the English Church. All of this going on while Cortes is interviewing with Charles, right? Back, you know, in the height of things. It's understandable that Charles is not going to be able to give his full attention to what's going on in Mexico. And Charles is there, charmed by Cortes, who knew how to turn on the charm. He has friends at court and he has enemies at court. Earlier on in another program, I was talking about the Fonseca, right? The bishop in Burgos, who was virtual head of colonial policy, the policy, American policy at that time. And one of the others who did not think very highly of him was the Queen. One of the people who did think highly of him was the Duke of Béjar. Now, the Duke of Béjar You can imagine the House of Béjar, originally from Navarra. On some of the programs last year, I was talking about the Castilianization of the Arista family, Eneca, how that became Íñigo, and how they went from, you know, Basque to Navarran. At one point, kicked out of Navarra, they were in the. They were in Estella, one of the valleys there called Stúnica. The Valley of Stúnica, or Estúniga, in the Merindad of Estella. This is when they began to talk of themselves, the Íñigueth of Stúnica. And that, over the years, was Castilianized to Thúñiga. And yes, the Thúñiga family. Again, they gave up their local lands. They went to Béjar. They were also present in Sevilla, in Seville. At one point, the entire Jewish quarter was destroyed in Seville in a pogrom, and the Thúñiga family, the Duques de Béjar, they took it over, including the synagogue, changed into a church, Santa Maria de la Blanca, and one of the most powerful families in Spain at this point. In time, right, under Charles V, all of this is being reorganized, and this is when we're talking about Los Grandes de España, this idea of the Grandes de España being the idea of Charles V. Yeah, what, 15 families initially, and one of them, the Thúñiga family, so Grandes de España, and a very important patron of Cortés, the Duke of Béjar, gives his daughter, Juana de Zúñiga, as wife of Cortés. Cortés, now 45 years old. Cortés, of course, on track to being the most important person in America, but still, you can imagine they get married. You can imagine the splendor of the wedding. Evidently, during that wedding, she was dressed up in as an Aztec princess. Right? Probably wearing jewelry. Jewelry of a woman who had probably been killed for her jewelry. I mean, remember the massacre in the temple, the person responsible for that. By the way, the person responsible for that, Alvarado. Now, he had his own story. Everywhere he went, the locals called him the sun, like sun in the sky, red sun in Nahuatl. Maybe because he had red hair. We don't know. We don't know why they called him the sun, but they did. In any case, on an earlier program, I was talking about the head of the Tlaxcalan tribe, the allies of Cortés, the ones basically really responsible for the destruction of the Aztec Empire, the ones who provided up to 200,000 of their own warriors in the destruction of the Aztec Empire. Okay, Xicotencatl, the elder, a man who was supposedly 102 years old, blind, but an ally. The great enemy was his son. Xicotencatl, the younger, who later walked out on Cortés and was executed by Cortés. Well, Xicoténcatl had a daughter, and he gave his daughter to Cortés, who already had La Malinche and how many others. But Cortés, in turn, gave her to Alvarado. And Alvarado had children by her. Evidently, they got along very well. She accompanied him everywhere. His legal marriages did not give him children, but she did. Her name was Luisa. She was obviously baptized. Luisa followed Alvarado into central Mexico. She called Doña and buried, by the way, in Guatemala Cathedral. Alvarado, if I remember correctly, was the governor of Guatemala at that time. In any case, these people, yes, marry well, but nobody is marrying as well as Cortés, marrying a Zúñiga, marrying the daughter of the Duke of Béjar. And at their wedding, with all of this American jewelry, must have been the talk of the town. Evidently, at that point, she earned the enmity of the queen, who never forgave her. Okay, I have to take a short break. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Ya está aquí la Agenda Vaughan, con la que aprenderás cada día con su contenido en inglés, en píldoras cómodas y fáciles de aprender. Bueno, eso, y que podrás recordar la reunión de mañana, la cita del médico y todo lo que necesites anotar para no olvidarte de nada con la Agenda Vaughan 2019. Ya a la venta en tiendas Vaughan o en vaughantienda.com. Ahora envío gratis. Infórmate.
Se dice un banco de peces en inglés.
A. A bank of fish. B. A bench of fish. C. A school of fish.
Te lo digo en menos de lo que tardaría un pez en olvidarse de esto. 2 minutos.
Si usted tiene un problema, tiene 3 opciones. Puede ignorarlo, puede hacer como que lo soluciona, o lo puede solucionar de verdad. Si los profesionales de su empresa tienen un problema con el inglés, usted tiene 3 opciones. Puede ignorarlo, puede hacer como que lo soluciona a medias, con unas cuantas clases de inglés, o lo puede solucionar de una vez por todas. Vaughan Incompany. Incompany es un profesor Vaughan que optimizará su inversión en la formación de inglés. Es un profesor Vaughan al servicio de su empresa, 4 u 8 horas al día. Incompany le ofrece a su empresa total flexibilidad. Usted decide quiénes van a clase y cuándo. Además, con la posibilidad de modificar la planificación a diario según las exigencias del negocio. Vaughan Incompany está para transformar a los profesionales de su empresa en comunicadores eficaces en inglés. Además, también está para ayudarles a preparar importantes reuniones internacionales, perfeccionar presentaciones, ayudarles a profesionalizar la comunicación, tanto interna como externa, en inglés, y les sirve como asesor general, sobre todo en lo relacionado con el idioma inglés. Vaughan & Company, la mejor inversión que usted puede hacer para optimizar el rendimiento de su empresa en el mundo de los negocios.
Pues ya que has dicho las edades que tenemos en el Club Junior.
Ya que hemos hablado de las edades, ¿no? Entre los 4 y 17 tenemos 2 segmentos grandes diferenciados, que son de 4 a 9 incluidos y de 10 a 17. De 4 a 9 los dividimos, los agrupamos según su edad, porque pues nos parece más importante sus intereses, sus habilidades, sus capacidades todavía cognitivas, eso es más importante que su nivel de inglés. Entonces pues se lo pasan, aunque a veces se puedas juntar con hijos de empleados, sobre todo que son bilingües, con pues un niño de 5 años, si lo emparejas con otro de ese mismo nivel de inglés será mayor y se van a aburrir. Y
va a ser frustrante para ellos, además.
Sí, entonces pues los agrupamos por edad. Y normalmente van pues los de 4 y 5 años juntos, 6 y 7, 8 y 9. Las clases para ellos son bastante más desenfadadas que para los más mayores. Es todo oral, todo prácticamente el 99% de la clase es oral. Y cuando son hasta los 7 años más o menos, sobre todo nos centramos en que entiendan que en su comprensión oral, ¿no? Tampoco es que vayan a, o sea, no hablan, un niño de 4 años todavía normalmente no habla mucho ni en su propio idioma, ya luego lo sabrá que no se calle ni debajo del, del agua. Entonces, pues al principio nos centramos sobre todo en lo que nosotros creemos que es lo más importante a la hora de aprender un idioma, que entiendan.
Yo
entiendan.
Estos días que están con los intensivos,
sí,
he visto muchos profes que son muy molones, ¿eh? Los ves, bueno, y los conocemos,
sí.
Y es que apetece meterse en clase y decir, jolín, yo quiero...
Que me den clase,
claro, es que son
chico.
Tan divertidos, tan dinámicos, con tanta energía.
Y ahí que están los niños tan campantes.
Importante, el teléfono es el 911-335832. Ese es el teléfono de Madrid. Si por lo que sea se interesan alguno de nuestros oyentes por...
Vigo, Barcelona...
Valencia, Valladolid...
Bilbao...
Santander...
Zaragoza...
Zaragoza... Y a lo mejor pronto en más sitios, pero ahí lo dejamos. Bueno, también pueden llamar al teléfono Madrid, donde se les facilitará más información de cómo contactar con nuestras delegaciones, o visitar la página web, que ahí vienen toda la información. Las direcciones, correos y teléfonos. Pero vamos a decir el de Madrid, y luego ya ahí ya nos distribuimos como podamos. 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832 o en grupobaugan.com, y ahí tienen toda la información.
Por sorprendente que pueda parecerte, un banco de peces en inglés es...
A school of fish.
Literalmente, una escuela de peces.
Bank.
Es banco, pero no de peces, de dinero. Y...
Bench.
Es un banco del parque.
Back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughn Radio, Baugan. Now, on the first part of the program, I was talking about what situation Charles V and the Holy Roman Empire, what situation things were in when Cortés came back from Mexico and asked for to be viceroy. He was not given the position of viceroy, but he was given lots of things. He was made the Marcus of the Valley, meaning the Valley of Mexico, with Oaxaca, with all sorts of possessions, more than 200 villages all over what is today Mexico. More than 20,000 vassals, let's call them slaves, as Indians, in the encomienda system that Cortés is very interested in reintroducing. As I say, he always had enemies at court, but now he has one very powerful friend, the Duque de Béjar, who has given his daughter to him as wife.
So yes, Cortés is marrying a Zúñiga. Now, supposedly it was at the wedding where the queen who had only been queen for about a year, the queen decided that the Zúñiga woman was better dressed than she was, or something like that. Or at least this is what some of the historians say. It sounds to me a little too much like cotilleo, gossip. It sounds a little too frivolous to me to think that it was simply a question of envy. But Juana de Zúñiga was a very important ally, and now Cortés's wife, and Isabel is going to be a very important enemy of Cortés. The fact is that Isabel was the reincarnation, practically, of her grandmother, of Isabel de Castilla. Just like Isabel de Castilla had been, you know, she had been calculating, intelligent. She had forceful, authoritarian when she had to be. Well, Isabel was the same. Isabel of Portugal. This idea of an alliance between Portugal and Spain was essential after the Tratado de Tordesillas, right? After the Treaty of Tordesillas, which had divided the world into, well, an American sphere, a Western Hemisphere under the control of Spain, and an Eastern Hemisphere, Asia, under the control of Portugal. Well, nobody liked it that way. And it was increasingly clear that the big markets, the big cities, they were all in Asia. But Portugal, of course, they wanted their position in the New World as well. And so this alliance between Spain and Portugal, it was everything that Reyes Católicos wanted. They had brought together Castile and Aragon, which only a couple of generations before had been at war. And they wanted to secure the peninsula. Unfortunately, some of their children died. But now it was up to the grandchild to marry her cousin Charles. She knew that's what she wanted. She told everybody, either I'm going to marry Charles or go into a convent as a nun. That's what she said. Now, it was essential that this alliance take place, that Portugal become part of Castile, not France. Again, the French, French control over Portugal would have been intolerable at this point. Thanks to Portugal, Castile had been able to pretty much take over the Canary Islands and exist in enclaves in Fez, like Melilla. And Portuguese support was absolutely crucial in the pacification of the Barbary Coast, right? North Africa. An alliance with Portugal was a guarantee. It would mean that the entire peninsula, now under one roof, let's put it that way. However, Charles was Flemish in his upbringing, a Flemish in his attitudes, and his advisors, the flamencos, that's why flamenco being so a synonym with color and sophistication. Well, flamenco, the Guillaume de Croix, right, William of Croix, convinced him that it would be much easier for him to marry his other cousin, Mary Tudor, the daughter of Henry VIII and of Catherine of Aragon, 16 years younger, still a child, so not available yet. He was going to have to wait. So yes, Charles, waiting and waiting and waiting. Now, Charles at one point got really impatient, and this idea of an allegiance with England, it went into the background. It was no longer considered as urgent. Charles wasn't getting any younger, wanted legitimate children. So they canceled the engagement to Mary Tudor. Naturally, it was going to be Charles's son who gets married to Mary Tudor. But in any case, they canceled his engagement. And it was time to think about Portugal. Now, she came with an enormous amount of money. So her dote, her dowry, was going to go a long way to paying some of the debts. Remember that in order to become Holy Roman Emperor, it was necessary for Charles to go deeply, deeply into debt. Deudas, debts, from which Castile, for example, never recovered. In 1526, Isabel came to Spain, and it was precisely the Duke of Béjar who escorted her to Seville. She arrived there in March, and Charles came a week later. Now, this was supposed to be a political arrangement, but like in the case of the, Isabel and Fernando, the Catholic monarchs, right? Just in the case of her grandmother, she fell in love. Actually, they both fell in love. There's no indication that they were not crazy in love for each other, even though Charles spent years and years outside of Spain. It was up to Isabel to run Spain in his absence. They had their, the wedding took place after midnight, 11th of March, in the Alcázar in Seville. And yes, he was there, for a short time. He was absent for long years. And Isabel, she was decisive in political policy, especially, again, the coordination with Portugal in the pacification of North Africa, and especially the whole Barbary piracy issue. Again, as the reincarnation of her grandmother, as a second Isabel de Castilla. She traveled extensively in Spain, and she really loved Avila because it doesn't get so hot in summer. She suffered from malaria at a time when everybody suffered from malaria. Cortes, of course, suffered from malaria. There were all kinds of health problems, universal at that time. But in any case, she meant she was a formidable, formidable enemy to Cortes. And so the emperor left for Flanders, and there was nothing for Cortes to expect by staying any longer in the court. So yeah, he left. He took his wife, the Marquesa, I believe in English that's Marchioness, the Marchioness, and his mother, and sailed for Hispaniola, from which they went to Veracruz. He returned to Mexico with a good income and his title. However, the queen had ordered that he could not enter the capital. Again, his enemies were in charge of the capital. Cortés, by the way, at this point, I believe the capital was entirely corrupt. It was like mafiosos entering power. And what they were doing was, well, inexcusable. But yes, Cortés kept away. He decided to stay at that city on the shore of the lake called Texcoco. And he and his bride became the most elegant, wonderful couple there. The new governor, Niño de Guzmán, was, an enemy of the conqueror, an enemy of Cortés, and, well, Cortés, in the end, disgusted with this treatment, left, went to Cuernavaca, where most of his estates were located, and built sort of a palace, but not a Renaissance palace, more like a medieval palace, right? Fortified. A palace suitable to a conquistador, right? Not a palace as much as a fortress. But still, living there like a king. The soldiers, now, the fact that Cortés chose Cuernavaca and this relaxation, let's put it that way, this idol. Well, the fact is that he was tired. He wanted to relax. He loved the beauty of nature. He wanted to be sort of a baron on his estate. He explored the Gulf of California, he went from there, sort of exploring a little more, because, well, just like back in Cuba, where he had everything he could want, right, with his first wife. He had everything he could want with his encomienda, and he could have lived there very satisfactorily. But ambition got in the way. And even at, you know, age 50 now, when other people are thinking of retiring, when other people are able to relax, he couldn't. Although he introduced the Merino sheep into Mexico. He brought sugar cane into that country. He became a successful planter in Cuernavaca. But again, life was too easy. He wanted difficulty. He was ambitious. He wanted more. Now, one of the things he wanted to do was to send ships directly to Asia, to the Spice Islands. He had the ships in line. He was ready to use them But there was all kinds of, again, bureaucratic interference from his enemies. There was a lot of red tape. And the ships simply, they were allowed to rot. They decayed, right? They pudrieron. His idea was to go from there and explore el Mar del Sur, right? The Southern Sea, what today we call the Pacific. And because he was so powerful, he was able to send out ships from Acapulco. They couldn't discover much. There was, of course, Baja California, Lower California, which naturally he claimed. At that point, they were thinking that California was probably an island, and California listed as an island, even though people knew, long after people knew that California was not an island, that Lower California, Baja California, is in fact a peninsula, it was still referred to as island. In any case, there isn't a lot there. The land is not particularly fertile, and compared to other parts of Mexico, there wasn't anything obvious that he wanted there. Eventually, he went with 400 colonists and 300 slaves to form a settlement, to form not a colony, but a vecindad, un pueblo, in Lower California. But this was a disaster. The locals killed many of the settlers. There wasn't enough food. Survivors finally taken back to Mexico, and many of the ships destroyed off the coast of Jalisco. Cortes went out to do everything he could for this new colony, but of course his wife got very, very nervous and sent ships to look for him. He believed that pearl fishing could be the future in this Gulf. And he sent an expedition under Captain Ulloa. This time his wife persuaded him not to go along. But that ship never returned to port. Again, at this point, the Sea of Cortez is starting to get a reputation like the Bermuda Triangle. Now, these expeditions on the Pacific coast were not cheap. And, he, of course, the Gulf is named the Sea of Cortez after him, but still, it was not the right way to spend so much money. And believe it or not, none of this is enough. None of this is enough for him. He has the castle. He has Cuernavaca. He has palaces near Mexico City, in Texcoco. He has silver mines in Zacatecas. He has gold in Oaxaca. And all of this coming in, the new viceroy, finally they get a viceroy in 1535. the Mendozas, right? The Mendozas from, well, actually from Granada. They had to do in Mexico what they had been so successful in doing in Granada, taking over the indigenous population with another religion and trying to transform, for example, the city of Granada into something less Muslim, more Christian, the same idea. Almost immediately, Mendoza building the central marketplace with soportales, arcades, and other things, making it a genuine sort of Spanish style city. This Mendoza, going out, thinking about the seven cities of Cibola, right? El Dorado. There was a monk who came back talking about gold toward the north. An enormous amount of gold in the north. And why not? This is just on the basis of a rumor. Pizarro at this time was in the south, in Peru. And he was going to be enormously successful in Cajamarca against Atahualpa, destroying the Inca Empire and getting more gold than anybody could possibly have imagined before. Well, the same rumor, El Dorado in the north, the seven cities of Cibola. But Cortes was not as interested in that as in going back to Spain. He determined to sail for Spain and talk to the emperor, complain to the emperor about everything that had gone wrong. And of course, now we get to the close of his life, but we are also at the time to take a break, because it's the end of the program. So thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
Descubre nuestros cursos trimestrales, la mejor forma de interiorizar los conceptos clave del inglés, con los mejores profesores que te enseñarán.